Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it came to explaining the vast cosmos to Americans, there was no one like superstar astronomer and great communicator of science, Carl Sagan. He reminded us of the billions and billions of mysteries that surround us. In books and lectures and on TV, he asked the really big questions.
How did the universe arise? What was around before that?
Carl Sagan died too young 10 years ago. But the big questions and emerging answers did not. This hour, we're going to listen back to Sagan, hear from his collaborator and wife of 20 years. But right now, we're joined and delighted to be by Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and director of the world-famous Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He is quite the rising communicator on science in his own right. His latest book is titled Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for having me.
So we're kind of looking out at the cosmos and back at Carl Sagan at the same time and trying to get a sense on where the understanding of science, the understanding of the public has come in the decade since Mr. Sagan left us. I wish you'd just open up with some thoughts. I mean, here you are. You've got a big bullhorn these days on science. He had an enormous one. How do you, as an astrophysicist and public communicator on science, look back on Carl Sagan?
Well, it's clear that Carl Sagan represented a kind of a portal through which science passed. And before Carl, to do what Carl did was considered odd or waste of a scientist's time.
That is, talking to the public about all this.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. To take time away from your lab to tell the public what it is you're doing or others are doing. Meanwhile, what it is you were doing was paid for by tax money, be it monies from the National Science Foundation or NASA. Mm-hmm. And so he did this first, and it was not an easy transition, of course. He was not widely loved by all of his colleagues. There are some who understood what he was doing, mm-hmm. and why he was doing it, and those are the ones with the foresight that we now all take for granted today. But he carved this path through a thicket that I now find myself on. I'm in this cleared
right.
range, as well as others who write books and appear before the public. So the public's appetite for science in general, but for the universe in particular, took a quantum leap forward in the days of Carl Sagan compared with what he went on before then.
Let's keep Carl Sagan's voice in our ear as we look back at his work and at our understanding of the cosmos today. I've got a little bit of tape here where Carl Sagan, as he often did, wanted to put Earth in perspective, emphasizing its size in comparison to the rest of the universe. He called the Earth a pale blue dot.
This dot is one of 9 planets that goes around a humdrum star that lives at the outskirts of a perfectly ordinary galaxy, which is composed of 400 billion other stars in a universe of maybe 100 billion galaxies. Yeah. In that context, what is the chance that we are the center or the point of the universe?
Neil deGrasse Tyson, as an astrophysicist, or in his case, an astronomer, this was a recurring theme, and it seems almost odd today. But maybe you don't think so. But trying to get humans on Earth to disabuse themselves of the notion that they were at the center of all, is it still an issue?
Yeah, well, there's no subject like the universe to work that fact into the dialogue. It doesn't take much to – you step away from the Earth and you just see how small we are and how cold and dark and lonely our corner of the universe is. It's very opposite how we've sort of built up the Earth and its presence in the universe in our mind's eye. And so the cosmic perspective is one that has, over time, has continuously deflated our ego, our sort of over-trumped-up sense of who and what we are and our place in the universe. And by the way, some people see this as a bad thing, but I see it as a good thing.
Because?
Because, well, the more mild your ego is, the less you might likely, the less likely you are to take
up
arms
against a neighbor. Distortion field. Oh, I see. Okay.
If you just look at human behavior, so much of the violence, so much of what is bad about human behavior issues forth from a trumped-up sense of the size of your ego. And take a look into the universe, and you are put in a cosmic perspective where you say, this little mote we call Earth, that's all we've got, and there's the whole rest of the universe here. How seriously can I take my concerns that, you know, we are different colors or religions or whatever? And so it's this context that the universe, when brought to the public, can actually have the potential to change human behavior in ways that I don't know that other sciences can.
We want to look back but also get an update on where the science that Carl Sagan loved talking about has moved since his life. One of his big themes was life beyond planet Earth. Neil deGrasse Tyson, I wish you'd listen with us for just a moment here. This is a conversation with PBS's Charlie Rose on January 5th, 1995, less than a year before his death, on life beyond Earth.
It is such an important question. We have the ability to find out the answers, send spacecraft to nearby worlds, use radio telescopes to see if anyone's sending us a message from a planet of another star. I'd be ashamed of my civilization if we had the tools to find out the answers and refused to look.
And refused to look. Neil deGrasse Tyson, what about it? In the decades since then, the interest in life beyond Earth and our... what, theories, hypotheses about life beyond Earth? Have they evolved? How?
By leaps and bounds. Mm. At the time that interview was given, I think we were just on the heels of discovering the very first planet in orbit around a star that was not the sun. Mm. And since then, the tally of planets is now rising through 250. So we now know of 250 solar systems, other places where we have stars and planets in orbit around them. So there's a start. That doesn't mean you found life yet, but that's a start, because life as we know it, we fully expect to occupy some planetary surface around a star. And so that's all happened since that interview. But not only that, the field of the search for life initially was viewed as kind of fringe because it was sort of contaminated by the expectations that you'll find little green men walking around the Martian surface.
Right.
But since then, in part because of certain funding umbrellas that NASA had provided in the late 1990s, the concept of the origins of planetary systems, of galaxies, of life, has brought together biologists and chemists and planetary geologists and astrophysicists all to answer common questions. And in that effort, what we have found is there's a whole world of ways to think about the search for life, searching for microbial life, searching for what effect life would have on the atmosphere of a planet, even if you can't see the life itself. Those are called biomarkers. Mm. So there's a whole burgeoning cottage industry of astrobiology right now that was only really even in its infancy back in the 1990s.
And has the likelihood of life elsewhere in the cosmos as understood by science, has it grown or decreased then in these, I mean, from Carl Sagan's view? He was quite himself, quite a believer or his scientific understanding that it would be there. Do you think he would feel bolstered by findings since then?
By all means. He was always a little more optimistic than others.
Yeah.
But what's happened is the data has sort of risen to justify his optimism. For example, for a long while, we sort of imagine this place we call the habitable zone, which is the orbital zone around a host star, where if your planet is there, you're not too close, otherwise the heat would evaporate your water, and you're not too far away, otherwise it would freeze. And liquid water being fundamental to life as we know it, that became the target zone of how you'd think about and search for life around other stars. And then we realize that you don't need the sun as your primary source of energy. One of Jupiter's moons, Europa, is heated by the gravitational stresses of Jupiter and other satellites, so that the ice there has become liquefied. There's a liquid ocean sitting beneath a frozen surface that must have been liquid for billions of years. So what I want to do is go ice fishing on Europa, check out, see who's what's swimming around down there. And that's well outside of the traditional habitable zone. And not only that, since the original Cosmos series, where planets were considered the targets of our interest, we've now since been out there in the outer solar system and found out that planet moons are just as much, if not more, interesting than the planets themselves. So we needn't now restrict the search for life to planets when you have a whole host of moons in orbit around them. So everything has become more enriched in our understanding of how you might look go about looking and finding life.
And talking to life out there, Carl Sagan was instrumental in any number of human messages sent out into space. Is that now seen as anachronistic or, you know, a kind of an antique notion or romantic?
Well, I would say of those methods, the one that's kind of romantic and not really likely to bring back much is in the Pioneer spacecraft and the Voyager spacecraft, the only spacecraft that had enough energy to leave the solar system completely. There was a gesture put aboard those crafts where there was a plaque put on the side that gave instructions of, well, not so much instructions, but a map of where the craft came from. Basically our home address, which is a little odd because you wouldn't give your home address to a stranger on the street.
Yeah. Carl Sagan was unique in his time for his access to the public imagination. In the 1970s, he began making guest appearances on The Tonight Show, hosted by Johnny Carson. Sagan called The Tonight Show, quoting him, the biggest classroom in history. He was on the show 26 times. He was such a familiar character there that Carson imitated him in this famous sketch with Ed McMahon in 1978.
Have you earned much income from your books?
I've made billions and billions.
Reports from Voyager 1 indicates that on Saturn, the winds are over 900 miles an hour. Will that pose a danger for our astronauts?
Definitely. They'll need much more hairspray than originally expected. Tremendous solar winds up there in the interstellar dust.
So there's the funny stuff, but it had a way of getting a lot of science across. There was a lot of serious message from Carl Sagan as well. For years on his series Cosmos, Carl Sagan warned of the dangers of global warming, a process that many people at that point had barely heard of. He cited conditions on other planets to make his argument. Here he is again later on the Charlie Rose Show in January 1995.
You take a look at Venus, you see a world with a surface temperature of 900 degrees Fahrenheit, produced by a massive carbon dioxide greenhouse effect, and never again will you be tempted to believe a radio talk show hosts who say that the greenhouse effect is something invented
somebody's
by liberals.
Somebody's imagination is not
right,
a danger.
By liberals. You look at Mars, and you see a planet without an ozone layer, in which ultraviolet light from the sun has in effect fried the surface so that even organic molecules cannot survive there. And never again will you say that there's no danger to depleting our ozone layer. We learn about our world by examining other worlds.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. There's Carl Sagan lecturing a decade and more ago on global warming, using other planets as a point of reference. That's a technique I don't see lately. Al Gore's got a different way of approaching it. Was Carl Sagan effective with his a demonstration via Venus on global warming?
Well, that was kind of a new approach to bringing Earth problems into focus at the time, and I've tried to do that ever since. By the way, I think I once wrote an essay called "Goldilocks and the Three Planets," referring to how different you have Venus, Earth, and then Mars, where here are these two other planets, one to our left, one to our right, in orbit around the sun, and it's the lessons to be gleaned from the examination of those two planets are beyond measure. When you look at Mars, it once had running water, more than just the ultraviolet flux that sterilizes its surface. It once had running water, as evidenced by dried riverbeds, meandering riverbeds, river deltas, floodplains, dried lake beds. The water is gone today. Maybe it's down in subsurface permafrost, but it's gone from the surface. Something bad happened on Mars, and I want to know what that is. And the knobs we're turning here on Earth, who knows whether we're going to one day end up looking like Mars. I don't want that to happen if I can help it. And so the comparative planetology is the kind of subject that helps us put our planet in cosmic context. without it, you think you're on an island, and you think you have, you think you can control everything, you know, when in fact we're embedded in this larger context that without which you can be taken by surprise, if not by a change in your climate, but by an asteroid that comes in through the dark of night.
And Carl Sagan put that insight right out there. I want to begin to hear from our listeners, if I may. Stephanie's calling from Milford, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you so much for taking my call. Through the magic of television, I grew up learning at Carl Sagan's knee. I not only learned about astronomy, but I was made aware of the dangers of global warming at a very early age, and Carl Sagan's view of humanity and the cosmos and how we really are just a pale blue dot whizzing through the universe really molded my life in the way that I conduct my life and recycle and try to be aware of the environment and other people. And I just was wondering, is there a way to bring his message to the children today so that way they can grow up and look to him as a role model and a way to conduct their lives?
Stephanie, let us pick that up. Certainly Neil deGrasse Tyson is doing that in his own way, in his own right, in quite an effective way. But let's put the question, if I may, to Andreenan, Carl Sagan's widow. She joins us from Ithaca, New York. Andreenan and Carl Sagan were, she was co-writer and producer for the PBS Cosmos with her husband, Carl Sagan. She was producer of the 1997 movie Contact, based on his novel of the same name. She's co-founder and CEO of Cosmos Studios, which has produced 4 documentaries, including the Emmy-nominated Cosmic Journey. She's helped put together, she's edited a collection of essays by Carl Sagan that's just come out called The Varieties of Scientific Experience, A Personal View of the Search for God. Andreenan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you, Tom, and Neil, my dear friend.
Hi, Annie. How are you doing?
Good. It's great to have you both and both together. And I think you heard there in Stephanie's question that kind of appreciation for the work that your husband did and the question about how this sort of education gets done today. Neil deGrasse Tyson is out there wailing away doing it. How do you see the public understanding 10 years after your husband's death, the trend in public understanding of the big kind of issues he was looking to raise?
Well, I'm extremely gratified by the listeners' remarks, and I'm happy to say that the Cosmos television series, which is out on DVD, continues to be an astonishing bestseller. We are selling as many Cosmos DVDs now as we did 10 years ago.
That is amazing, all these years later.
It is amazing. And I think it's because it really has legs, because it's one of the few efforts at public education, public science education, that's not afraid of the spiritual uplift that comes from understanding nature. And, of course, we have this new book out by Carl called Varieties of Scientific Experience, which is Carl's kind of definitive statement about these issues. So we're also in talks to perhaps do a new Cosmos with Steve Soter, who was our co-writer on the last one. And there are a lot of stories in science that we want to tell. And so, I think the hunger for this kind of material is as great as it ever was.
Let me ask you about this collection of essays. And the subtitle, of course, A Personal View of the Search for God, the debate over evolution and creationism, the public religiosity of sectors of American society has certainly grown in the decades since Carl Sagan's death. Take us into the core themes of this collection of essays. How do you think he would have responded to the direction of public discourse around science and religion over this past decade?
Well, I think he would have been disheartened, to say the least, because of the rise of fundamentalism, which he actually prophesies in the Varieties of Scientific Experience. And I think he would have felt that, you know, the idea of refighting battles over evolution at this late date is a kind of a discouraging phenomenon. And I think he was a searcher. He didn't see the world divided up into believers and atheists, but he thought it was divided up into the people who really thought that our spiritual understanding of the universe was completed, and the rest of us who perhaps had a greater sense of humility about these things and felt that the answers, had not really been fully come in. So so Carl was a searcher, and I think his he was advocating that we should open our hearts and our minds to the revelations of science, not just accept them intellectually as a kind of compartmentalized body of knowledge, but actually to have our spiritual perspective affected by them.
He said, science is not only compatible with spirituality, it is a profound source of spirituality. Neil deGrasse Tyson, do you feel as a communicator on science today that you're facing kind of headwinds that Carl Sagan may not have with the changing cultural trends around religiosity in this country?
Yeah, there are. That's an excellent way to describe it. They are headwinds. And some of the sort of the effort to resort to religious thinking, some of that does not directly touch the scientific frontier. My efforts when these headwinds blow the strongest are primarily when you see these movements try to put patently religious philosophies into the science classroom. And that's where I would jump in the ring and sort of offer perspective that that make it clear that first that one shouldn't do that, but not only that, the universe itself is, as Anne and Carl have said multiple times in many different ways, the universe itself is a source of profound uplifting spirituality. Once you know how you fit into the universe chemically, biologically, atomically, then you it brings to the learner a whole other sense of appreciation for their place in the cosmos. And when you do that, people, I think, can respect the fact that you can feel spiritual but have that spirituality be grounded in empirical science.
Let's listen to a little bit of Carl Sagan on that front. He often said that, quoting him, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, no less the existence of God. On the series Cosmos, he visited India and talked about the relationship of deities there to the perception of the universe.
There is the deep and appealing notion that the universe is but the dream of the god, who, after 100 Brahma years, dissolves himself into a dreamless sleep, and the universe dissolves with him. Until, after another Brahma century, he stirs, recomposes himself, and begins again to dream the great cosmic lotus dream. It is said that men may not be the dreams of the gods, but rather that the gods are the dreams of men.
Carl Sagan on Cosmos. Carl Sagan's widow and longtime collaborator Anne Drinan is with us from Ithaca, New York. Neil deGrasse Tyson is with us from New York City. Right now, Jeremy's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey. Hey, Neil. How you doing?
Hello.
I'd first like to say that Carl Sagan's Cosmos, without question, got me to get my PhD in astrophysics in Princeton back in the 90s. And, you know, I'd really like to thank Anne for putting that together. It was a direct motivation to me. Let me get to my question, which is that, you know, Carl Sagan really, you know, I think he really worked on a deeper question, which is trying to how to make us better appreciate our own world by having us appreciate the beauty that's all around there. And I always thought his deepest statement was that, you know, we are star stuff, that the atoms in our body were made in supernovas, and that's about as you know, big a beginning as you can imagine. I just would like to get the speaker's comments on those thoughts. Thanks.
Jeremy, thank you. Neil, understanding ourselves through understanding star stuff, does it work for you?
Oh, definitely. Oh, by all means. In fact, in any lecture that I give, that message is always the strongest message. And I try to save it for last because then that becomes the taste in their mouth that they take with them. The idea that we are connected to the universe in this fundamental way, I know of no more spiritual thought than that. And what's interesting is, of course, why people don't generally know that fact is because that was gleaned over like a decade of time by multiple scientists, culminating in a research paper in the 1950s that put together the fact that you have fusion in stars and stars blow up and we're made of that stuff. And so there you have it. But it wasn't some lone researcher working overnight, so it didn't make for good newspaper copy when it happened. And so it takes the rest of us to try to bring that message to the public.
Mm. Andreanan, your husband's manner of communicating that, I mean, you know, I don't hear it quite that way anymore. Maybe it was the time, but the dream, to dream the great cosmic lotus dream, that has a very Sagan-y, almost 60s sound about it. Do you still feel people resonating to the "we are made of star stuff" message of Carl Sagan?
Oh, I absolutely do. And I was so glad that the caller brought that up, because contrast "we are made of star stuff" with the notion that we are the clay of a disappointed creator who finds us inadequate in every way.
That's it's a very stark picture.
It's a very stark comparison. And the idea that every fiber in our being, every atom, every molecule, comes from the fiery explosions of distant stars, it's a magnificent notion. And it takes us away from seeing us as a kind of pathetically flawed species, to beings who have the potential within us not only to become the kind of human beings that we want to become, but also to return to those very stars.
Mm. Neil deGrasse Tyson, Carl Sagan, I'm quoting him here. He said, "In every country, we should be teaching our children the scientific method and the reasons for a Bill of Rights," a political angle here. "With it comes a certain decency, humility, and community spirit. In the demon-haunted world that we inhabit by virtue of being human, this may be all that stands between us and the enveloping darkness." The demon-haunted world that we inhabit. How do you interpret that, Neil?
Well, I think it's clear. In the pre-scientific era, before people had any access or any knowledge or any insight into how to come to understand the natural world around you, we were just completely victims of our imaginations, basically. You would try to account for things you didn't understand by inventing some storyline. And if what you didn't understand was a little bit spooky, then there were demons accountable for it. And so the era of science, if it were natural to think scientifically, then science as we practice it today would be much older than only the half a millennium that we've been practicing it. We've been doing it, we would have been doing it from the era of cavemen, but that's not the case. It's a relatively recent addition to the portfolio of what it is to be human. And so it's you have to teach it. It has to be brought to you. So that you can see how it works, and then it's empowering once you know how it works. You can then take it to understand and decode your own world in which you live.
In January 2004 at NASA headquarters, President Bush endorsed the idea of one day sending a manned expedition to Mars. Carl Sagan was fascinated by just that prospect, and on his TV show in the 80s described what it might look like.
"We first need more robotic missions, including rovers, balloons, and return sample missions, and more experience in long-duration spaceflight. But eventually, if all goes well, the interplanetary ship or ships would be constructed in Earth orbit, launched on the long journey to Mars, and then a landing module would set down on the surface. The crew would emerge, making the first human footfalls on another planet."
Music, long vowels, and Carl Sagan makes it all dramatic. They're in the 80s looking forward to Mars exploration. Josh is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
I'd like to say that Carl Sagan has been a lifelong inspiration to me. I grew up with Cosmos, and I've read, I think, everything that he's written. And in the past few years, sort of his work, the Planetary Society and everything, sort of it's inspired me to start a space business.
What kind of space business, Josh?
I'm developing the world's first space sculpture.
And what does that mean, sir?
It's a 100-meter ring. It's a 325-foot ring with a digital display on it to show people's postcards.
When does it go up, Josh?
It's a artistic evolutionary project in the next 10 years.
Right.
And also, I met Dr. deGrasse Tyson at this year's XPRIZE. He gave a nice little demonstration of free fall at the VR skydive booth.
That's great, and you're dreaming big and looking to put it up. Josh, thanks for joining us. Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, I wish you'd help walk us into some of the new terrain that's opened in the decade since Carl Sagan was educating Americans and the world about the space and the cosmos. Take us out to some of the frontiers where our scientific understanding has really moved forward since then.
Well, a couple of things. First, there are the matter of those 250 planets discovered since he died, planets in orbit around other stars. And these are nice starting points for thinking about and posing the next round of questions about planets in the galaxy and whether or not they will contain life. That what will follow that are plans to then study the atmospheres of planets, first find out if there are any Earth-like planets out there, and then find ways to detect the atmosphere. Because if you do that, the atmosphere can hold the signs that what could be going on in the ground could be life. There could be life thriving on the surface of the planet. Oxygen, methane, there are other molecules that are otherwise unstable were it not for the action of life on the surface. But not only that, since then, we've discovered that the universe is accelerating, not only expanding, which we've known since Hubble made his 1929 discovery, but we now know that in that expansion it's accelerating by this mysterious pressure whose origin we have no clue, but we can measure its effect. And it tells us that in the distant future, all these galaxies that are expanding will expand beyond our horizon, leaving us sort of alone once again, this time literally rather than in our mind.
What are the implications of that?
Well, there'll be a day when there's just the stars of our galaxy and no other visible galaxy in the universe. And it's an odd sort of place to be put back to if that generation of astrophysicists do not have the records of what we now know about the galaxies in the universe. They would have to create a whole new cosmology that didn't include an expanding universe or other galaxies. There'd be a chapter torn out of their access to data.
Amazing.
And so I lay awake at night wondering, is there some chapter that we're missing?
That's already receded from our view somehow.
Right. That somehow's preventing us from completing that book. Also, since then, we found that there are supermassive black holes lurking in the centers of most galaxies, essentially every galaxy we've had good enough data to make this measurement on. And so black holes have a fascinating role in just how they wreak havoc on what would otherwise be ordinary orbits and ordinary gas clouds.
Andrian, that's a big development, learning that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, whole galaxies moving beyond our ken. It sounds like just the kind of thing that Carl would have picked up and loved contemplating.
Yes, how I wish I could communicate with him about all of the great discoveries of the last 10 years. Every time Cassini or Huygens or one of the great Mars missions would send back new data, it was a pang in my heart not to think that Carl would never know about such things. But,
and imagine what new vocabulary words could have long vowels get pronounced again.
Yes, at the very least. And but that's the strength and the wonder of science is the methodology of science. It makes it a kind of permanent revolution, so that nothing stays still. It's engineered so that change is built in, and the tolerance for change, unlike so many other human institutions, the method of science makes that possible.
He was famed and had a huge impact, and at the same time, with a lot of affection, typically widely kind of imitated by every comedian under the sun. What did he think about that, Anne? Did he enjoy that? Was that just part of the package? Did he delight in it?
He loved Johnny Carson as a great friend and someone who was very knowledgeable about astronomy and just a wonderful human being. And it really didn't bother him at all. I mean, I think he felt that it was a kind of healthy indication of the impact he was having. And you know, even when his colleagues were abusive to him because of the fact that he did so much public education, he always said that science was its own reward and that He had nothing to complain about. He was really the luckiest guy around.
Billions and billions. Nancy's calling from Thomaston, Connecticut. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just want to thank Neil deGrasse Tyson and also Brian Greene for the wonderful work they do on PBS.
Yes.
I love the shows, and it's really great. Also,
Yes, Nancy, we hear you.
And also, a question. What do they think about, what does Neil think about landing Earthlings on Mars?
The idea of the manned mission to Mars. Let's pick it up. Neil, what do you say?
Well, if I wear my sort of pure scientist hat, and then you look at the cost of sending people versus robots, it's kind of, there's no contest there. You know, for every one human mission, you can send 10 or 50 robotic missions. So if you're talking about simply a return on a dollar, the return on the dollar for robots far exceeds that of humans. There's no question about this. But I wear more than just a scientist hat. I wear sort of the hat of, or at least I am sensitive to, the needs and wishes and wants of the public. And what I found in just my conversations and talks I've given is that the public resonates with other members of our species in ways that does not happen with robots. So, for example, you know, there are no high schools named after robots, but there are high schools named after astronauts, living and fallen astronauts. Mm. And so that kind of vicarious participation on the explorational frontier is something that we should not undervalue, first of all. But second, every geologist I know, if you say, should we send you or a robot, they want to send themselves and carry their hammer with them. So I'm not going to get in the way of the geologist who wants to go bounding around the surface of Mars to get these data. But what's in the current vision for space exploration, what you really want is the sensible combination of both. Not all tasks are best suited for robots, and not all and the reverse of that. You want the combination of those two to come to bear on the questions you'll be asking about your discoveries.
Mm-hmm. Carl Sagan, of course, a big proponent of space exploration, and it seems to me, listening to him, the idea of humans being out there. Here he is in January 95, calling for just that, space exploration.
I don't for a moment say that the Earth is a disposable planet. We have to make the most heroic efforts to preserve it and us. But I still think it would be a good insurance policy, hedging our bets, or as Republicans like to say, diversifying our portfolios, for there to be humans on other worlds as well as here.
Andrian, there are two things at once, his interest in space exploration, humans in space, and also his concern about the durability of this planet, which is very much in the news these days.
Well, of course, he was concerned, and he was, the first person most of us ever heard talking about global warming, inadvertent climate modification, nuclear winter, ozone layer. He was a conscientious citizen of the planet Earth, and his passion for public education was an aspect of this kind of citizenship. I'm very proud, in fact, that in An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's film, he acknowledges Carl a couple of times for his influence on Vice President Gore in coming to this subject. And he was most concerned about that. But he also felt that we have a big testosterone burden on this planet that could be put to better use than war. And he felt that the heroic exploration of the cosmos was an excellent way to utilize both these great quantities of testosterone mm-hmm. and the power of the military-industrial complex. And I think he would have been just horrified at how far we've drifted away from the exploratory vision and how brutal and violent our society is now.
Take that passion and push it out into space. Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Dr. Tyson.
Hello.
Forgive me, I'm just an ant looking at a calculus book and can't comprehend some of your terms. Can you explain to me your definition of spirituality? I get confused and my brain hurts when you say the cosmos is physical and we should make that our spirituality. Doesn't that really imply that there is another aspect of existence, a spiritual one? But the definition seems to need some explanation.
I'd like to offer one, but I know Ann Shirley has a perspective on this as well.
Sure.
Neil, you go first, and then I'd like to go after you.
Sure. Of course, the root of the word spiritual is the word spirit, and traditional invocations of that word typically refer to, if not bad spirits, but good spirits, but they're nonetheless sort of paranormal religious phenomenon. And the way I've been using it is I've co-opted the term to recognize the fact that people who have deeply religious spiritual experiences react in a particular way that brings upon them some sense or perception of fulfillment, of some sense of happiness about their understanding of their place in the world, the meaning of life, if you will. And I think there's so many people don't recognize that many of those same feelings are available to us simply by learning about how the universe works and learning about what our place is in the universe. And so if those same feelings come over you for having studied it in that way, then I feel justified to use that same word to describe those feelings, not as an invocation of spirits and goblins and demons, but as a honest assessment of the feeling that comes over you when you come to terms with our place in the cosmos.
And Carl Sagan said science, we quoted him earlier, is a profound source of spirituality. Robert says, well, how do you define what here?
Well, and in this new book, Carl talks about science as being informed worship, and that is a way of loving nature. I ask you, what is a deeper form of love, that love for someone or something that consists entirely of our preconceived notions unmitigated by reality, or a love that comes from the deepest form of understanding, from knowing something, how it works, what it's made of on the finest scale? To me, that's a higher form of love, a greater form of humility. And I get that through science. I don't get that through conventional religion because too much of it is geocentric, is centered around human beings, and is contemptuous of nature. And so I'm with Neil. I'm not going to cede spirituality to people who believe in the supernatural and things which I consider to be somewhat irrational. I want that feeling, that uplift, and I get it from understanding nature, our continuing understanding. Of course, science can't give us an absolute truth, and people who want absolute truth find it unsatisfying. But for me, the ambiguity and the mystery is more than enough.
And with that, we're right in the middle of today's debates across this culture. Neil, our time grows short. What developments in scientific understanding in the last 10 years do you think might have surprised Carl Sagan the most? Are we finding, apart from the new planets, are we finding things that might be in opposition to his understanding, or it might be leading us in directions he would not have anticipated?
Yeah, I'd like to take on one. There's the idea of diversifying our portfolio by having humans live and work and play
off-site, off-planet,
off-planet. I'm at slight odds with that. I mean, I agree. That's a fundamentally true statement that if you're on more than one planet, something bad happens on one planet, the species survives it. However, our capacity to influence our environment, while it could render us extinct, it is also growing at a pace that will allow us to control that which might have made us extinct in the first place. For example, if an asteroid is headed our way, and it's the kind that would render us all extinct, something the size of Mount Everest, like what took out the dinosaurs, then you have two options. You can say, all right, everybody move to Mars until this is over. Or you can add up, what is that effort? Or deflect the thing. Okay? And so our capacity to protect our home is growing at just the rate that it may need to be to prevent extinction in the scenarios that Carl was describing. Mm. And you just have to compare the effort. What does it take to move a billion people off the planet to another planet and pitch 10 so that they can survive or deflect the thing in the first place? But otherwise, he was such a front thinker, I don't think anything would have surprised him.
Well, there, once again, even 10 years later, Carl Sagan has us thinking and looking outward. Neil deGrasse Tyson, we're very grateful to you for taking your time today to help us do just that. You know, your new book is Death by a Black Hole. Listeners, you can see it at our website. Neil, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure on your show. Thanks for having me.
And Anne, widow of Carl Sagan, editor of the new book, The Varieties of Scientific Experience. Anne, thank you very much for being here.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.